Disc 2.
Going round the house agents was not a prolonged labour. There were only two house agents in Dilmouth. Messrs. Wilkinson's were a comparatively new arrival. They had only opened their premises 11 years ago. They dealt mostly with the small bungalows and new houses at the far end of the town. The other agents, Messrs. Galbraith and Penderley, were the ones from whom Gwenda had bought the house. Calling upon them, Giles plunged into his story. He and his wife were delighted with Hillside and with Dilmouth generally. Mrs. Reed had only just discovered that she had actually lived in Dilmouth as a small child. She had some very faint memories of the place, and had an idea that Hillside was actually the house in which she had lived, but could not be quite certain about it. Had they any record of the house being let to a Major Halliday? It would be about 18 or 19 years ago. Mr. Penderley stretched out apologetic hands. "I'm afraid it's not possible to tell you, Mr. Reed. Our records do not go back that far. Not, that is, of furnished or short-period lets. Very sorry I can't help you, Mr. Reed. As a matter of fact, if our old head clerk, Mr. Narracott, had still been alive, he died last winter, he might have been able to assist you. A most remarkable memory. Really, quite remarkable. He had been with the firm for nearly 30 years. There's no one else who could possibly remember. Our staff is all on the comparatively young side. Of course, there is old Mr. Galbraith himself. He retired some years ago. Perhaps I could ask him, said Gwenda. Well, I hardly know about that. Mr. Penderley was dubious. He had a stroke last year. His faculties are sadly impaired. He's over 80, you know. Does he live in Dilmouth? Oh, yes, at Calcutta Lodge. Very nice little property on the Seaton Road. But I really don't think... "'It's rather a forlorn hope,' said Giles to Gwenda. "'But you never know. "'I don't think we'll write. "'We'll go there together and exert our personality.' "'Calcutta Lodge was surrounded by a neat, trim garden, "'and the sitting-room into which they were shown "'was also neat, if slightly overcrowded. "'It smelt of beeswax and ronnock. "'Its brasses shone. "'Its windows were heavily festooned. "'A thin, middle-aged woman with suspicious eyes came into the room.' Giles explained himself quickly, and the expression of one who expects to have a vacuum cleaner pushed at her left Miss Galbraith's face. "'I'm sorry, but I really don't think I can help you,' she said. "'It's so long ago, isn't it?' "'One does sometimes remember things,' said Gwenda. "'Of course, I shouldn't know anything myself. I never had any connection with the business. "'A Major Halliday, you said. "'No, I never remember coming across anyone in Dilmouth of that name. "'Your father might remember, perhaps,' said Gwenda. "'Father?' Miss Galbraith shook her head. "'He doesn't take much notice nowadays, and his memory's very shaky.' Gwenda's eyes were resting thoughtfully on a Benares brass table, and they shifted to a procession of ebony elephants marching across the mantelpiece. "'I thought he might remember, perhaps,' she said. "'Because my father had just come from India. "'Your house is called Calcutta Lodge?' "'She paused, interrogatively. "'Yes,' said Miss Galbraith. "'Father was out in Calcutta for a time, in business there. "'Then the war came, and in 1920 he came into the firm here, "'but would have liked to go back, he always says. "'But my mother didn't fancy foreign parts. "'And, of course, you can't say the climate's really healthy. "'Well, I don't know.' "'Perhaps you'd like to see my father. "'I don't know if it's one of his good days.' "'She led them into a small black study. "'Here, propped up in a big, shabby leather chair, "'sat an old gentleman with a white walrus moustache. "'His face was pulled slightly sideways. "'He eyed Gwenda with distinct approval "'as his daughter made the introduction.
"'Memory's not what it used to be,'
he said in a rather indistinct voice.
"'Halliday, you say?' "'No, I don't remember the name. "'Knew a boy at school in Yorkshire. "'That's 70-odd years ago.'
"'He rented Hillside, we think,' said Giles.
"'Hillside? Was it called Hillside, then?'
"'Mr. Galbraith's one movable eyelid snapped shut and open.
"'Finderson lived there. Fine woman.'
"'My father might have rented it, furnished. "'He'd just come from India.'
"'India? India, do you say?' I remember a fellow, army man, knew that old rascal Mohammed Hassan, who cheated me over some carpets. had a young wife and a baby, a little girl.
That was me, said Gwenda firmly.
Indeed, you don't say so. Well, well, time flies. Now, what was his name? Wanted a place furnished. Yes, Mrs. Finderson had been ordered to Egypt or some such place for the winter, all tomfoolery. Now, what was his name?
Halliday, said Gwenda.
That's right, my dear. Halliday. Major Halliday. Nice fellow. Very pretty wife. Quite young. Fair-haired. Wanted to be near her people or something like that. Yes, very, very pretty.
Who were her people?
Oh, no idea at all. No idea. You don't look like her.
Gwenda nearly said she was only my stepmother, but refrained from complicating the issue. She said, what did she look like? Unexpectedly, Mr. Galbraith replied,
looked worried. That's what she looked, worried. Yes, very nice fellow, that major chap. Interested to hear I'd been out in Calcutta. Not like these chaps that have never been out of England. Narrow, that's what they are. Now I've seen the world. What was his name, that army chap? Wanted a furnished house.
He was like a very old gramophone, repeating a worn record.
St. Catherine's, that's it. Took St. Catherine's. 6 guineas a week, while Mrs. Finderson was in Egypt. Died there, poor soul. House was put up for auction. Who bought it now? Elworthy's, yes, that's it. Pack of women, sisters. Changed the name. Said St. Catherine's was popish. Very down on anything popish. Used to send out tracts. Plain women, all of them. Took an interest in the blacks. Send them out trousers and Bibles. Very strong on converting the heathen.
He sighed suddenly and leant back.
Long time ago, he said fretfully. Can't remember names. Chap from India. Nice chap. Oh, I'm tired, Gladys. I'd like my tea.
Giles and Gwenda thanked him, thanked his daughter, and came away. So, that's proved, said Gwenda. My father and I were at Hillside. What do we do next? I've been an idiot, said Giles. Somerset House. What's Somerset House? Asked Gwenda. It's a record office where you can look up marriages. I'm going there to look up your father's marriage. According to your aunt, your father was married to his second wife immediately on arriving in England. Don't you see, Gwenda? It ought to have occurred to us before. It's perfectly possible that Helen may have been a relation of your stepmother's, a younger sister, perhaps. Anyway, once we know what her surname was, we may be able to get on to someone who knows about the general set-up at Hillside. Remember, the old boy said they wanted a house in Dilmouth to be near Mrs. Halliday's people. If her people live near here, we may get something. Giles, said Gwenda, I think you're wonderful. Giles did not, after all, find it necessary to go to London. Though his energetic nature always made him prone to rush hither and thither and try to do everything himself, he admitted that a purely routine inquiry could be delegated. He put through a trunk call to his office. "Got it!" he exclaimed enthusiastically when the expected reply arrived. From the covering letter he extracted a certified copy of a marriage certificate. "Here we are, Gwenda. Friday, August the 7th, Kensington Registry Office. Kelvin James Halliday to Helen Spenlove Kennedy." Gwenda cried out sharply, "Helen!" They looked at each other. Giles said slowly, But it can't be her. I mean, they separated and she married again and went away.
We don't know, said Gwenda, that she went away.
She looked again at the plainly written name, Helen Spenlove Kennedy. Helen. Chapter 7. Dr. Kennedy. A few days later, Gwenda, walking along the esplanade in a sharp wind, stopped suddenly beside one of the glass shelters which a thoughtful corporation had provided for the use of its visitors.
"Miss Marple?" she exclaimed in lively surprise, for indeed Miss Marple it was, nicely wrapped up in a thick fleecy coat and well wound round with scarves. "Quite a surprise to you, I'm sure, to find me here," said Miss Marple briskly, "but my doctor ordered me away to the seaside for a little change, and your description of Dilmouth sounded so attractive that I decided to come here, especially as the cook and butler of a friend of mine take in boarders."
"But why didn't you come and see us?" demanded Gwenda.
"Old people can be rather a nuisance, my dear. Newly married young couples should be left to themselves." She smiled at Gwenda's protest. "I'm sure you'd have made me very welcome. And how are you both? And are you progressing with your mystery?"
"Oh, we're hot on the trail," Gwenda said, sitting beside her. She detailed their various investigations up to date. "And now," she ended, "we've put an advertisement in lots of papers, local ones and the Times and the other big dailies. We've just said, will anyone with any knowledge of Helen Spenlove Halliday, nay, Kennedy, communicate, etc.? I should think, don't you, that we're bound to get some answers?"
"I should think so, my dear. Yes, I should think so." Miss Marple's tone was placid as ever, but her eyes looked troubled. They flashed a quick appraising glance at the girl sitting beside her. That tone of determined heartiness did not ring quite true. Gwenda, Miss Marple thought, looked worried. What Dr. Haydock had called the implications were perhaps beginning to occur to her. Yes, but now it was too late to go back. Miss Marple said gently and apologetically, "I have really become most interested in all this. My life, you know, has so few excitements. I hope you won't think me very inquisitive if I ask you to let me know how you progress."
"Of course we'll let you know," said Gwenda warmly. "You shall be in on everything. Why, but for you, I should be urging doctors to shut me up in a loony bin. Tell me your address here, and then you must come and have a drink. I mean, have tea with us and see the house. You've got to see the scene of the crime, haven't you?"
She laughed, but there was a slightly nervy edge to her laugh. When she had gone on her way, Miss Marple shook her head very gently and frowned. Giles and Gwenda scanned the mail eagerly every day, but at first their hopes were disappointed. All they got was two letters from private inquiry agents who pronounced themselves willing and skilled to undertake investigations on their behalf.
"Time enough for them later," said Giles. "If we do have to employ some agency, it will be a thoroughly first-class firm, not one that touts through the mail. But I don't really see what they could do that we aren't doing." His optimism, or self-esteem, was justified a few days later. A letter arrived, written in one of those clear and yet somewhat illegible handwritings that stamp the professional man. "Galls Hill, Woodley Bolton. Dear Sir, in answer to your advertisement in the Times, Helen Spenlove Kennedy is my sister. I have lost touch with her for many years, and should be glad to have news of her. Yours faithfully, James Kennedy, M.D.
"Woodley Bolton," said Giles. "That's not too far away. Woodley Camp is where they go for picnics, up on the moorland, about 30 miles from here. We'll write and ask Dr. Kennedy if we may come and see him, or if he would prefer to come to us."
A reply was received that Dr. Kennedy would be prepared to receive them on the following Wednesday, and on that day they set off. Woodley Bolton was a straggling village set along the side of a hill. Galls Hill was the highest house, just at the top of the rise, with a view over Woodley Camp and the moors towards the sea.
"Rather a bleak spot," said Gwenda, shivering.
The house itself was bleak, and obviously Dr. Kennedy scorned such modern innovations as central heating. The woman who opened the door was dark and rather forbidding. She led them across the rather bare hall and into a study where Dr. Kennedy rose to meet them. It was a long, rather high room, lined with well-filled bookshelves. Dr. Kennedy was a grey-haired elderly man with shrewd eyes under tufted brows. His gaze went sharply from one to the other of them.
"Mr. and Mrs. Reed? Sit down, Mrs. Reed. It's probably the most comfortable chair. Now, what's all this about?"
Giles went fluently into their prearranged story. He and his wife had been recently married in New Zealand. They had come to England, where his wife had lived for a short time as a child, and she was trying to trace old family friends and connections. Dr. Kennedy remained stiff and unbending. He was polite, but obviously irritated by colonial insistence on sentimental family ties.
"And you think my sister, my half-sister, and possibly myself, are connections of yours?"
he asked Gwenda, civilly, but with slight hostility.
"She was my stepmother," said Gwenda. "My father's second wife. I can't really remember her properly, of course. I was so small. My maiden name was Halliday."
He stared at her, and then suddenly a smile illuminated his face. He became a different person, no longer aloof.
"Good Lord," he said, "don't tell me that you're Gwenny."
Gwenda nodded eagerly. The pet name, long forgotten, sounded in her ears with reassuring familiarity.
"Yes," she said, "I'm Gwenny."
"God bless my soul! Grown up and married! How time flies! It must be, what, 15 years? No, 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 of course, much longer than that. You don't remember me, I suppose?"
Gwenda shook her head.
"I don't even remember my father. I mean, it's all a vague kind of blur."
"Of course. Halliday's first wife came from New Zealand, I remember his telling me so. A fine country, I should think."
"It's the loveliest country in the world. But I'm quite fond of England, too."
"On a visit, or settling down here?"
He rang the bell.
"We must have some tea."
When the tall woman came, he said, "Tea, please, and hot buttered toast, or cake, or something." The respectable housekeeper looked venomous, but said, "Yes, sir," and went out.
"I don't usually go in for tea," said Dr. Kennedy, vaguely, "but we must celebrate."
"It's very nice of you," said Gwenda. "No, we're not on a visit. We've bought a house."
She paused and added,
"Hillside."
Dr. Kennedy said vaguely, "Oh, yes, in Dilmouth. You wrote from there."
"It's the most extraordinary coincidence," said Gwenda. "Isn't it, Giles?"
"I should say so," said Giles. "Really quite staggering."
"It was for sale, you see," said Gwenda,
and added in the face of Dr. Kennedy's apparent non-comprehension,
"It's the same house where we used to live long ago."
Dr. Kennedy frowned.
"Hillside? But surely I—" "Oh, yes, I did hear they'd changed the name. Used to be St. something or other, if I'm thinking of the right house, on the Leehampton Road, coming down into the town on the right-hand side."
"Yes,
that's the one. Funny how names go out of your head. Now, wait a minute. St. Catherine's, that's what it used to be called."
"And I did live there, didn't I?" Gwenda said.
"Yes, of course you did."
He stared at her, amused.
"Why did you want to come back there? You can't remember much about it, surely."
"No, but somehow it felt like home."
"It felt like home," the doctor repeated. There was no expression in the words, but Giles wondered what he was thinking about.
"So, you see," said Gwenda, "I hoped you'd tell me about it all, about my father and Helen and—" she ended lamely, "and everything."
He looked at her reflectively.
"I suppose they didn't know very much out in New Zealand. Why should they? Well, there isn't much to tell. Helen, my sister, was coming back from India on the same boat with your father. He was a widower with a small daughter. Helen was sorry for him or fell in love with him. He was lonely or fell in love with her. Difficult to know just the way things happen. They were married in London on arrival and came down to Dilmouth to me. I was in practice there. Kelvin Halliday seemed a nice chap, rather nervy and run down, but they seemed happy enough together. Then—"
He was silent for a moment before he said,
"However, in less than a year, she ran away with someone else. You probably know that."
"Who did she run away with?" asked Gwenda.
He bent his shrewd eyes upon her.
"She didn't tell me," he said. "I wasn't in her confidence. I'd seen—I couldn't help seeing— that there was friction between her and Kelvin. I didn't know why. I was always a straight-laced sort of fellow, a believer in marital fidelity. Helen wouldn't have wanted me to know what was going on. I'd heard rumours, one does, but there was no mention of any particular name. They often had guests staying with them who came down from London or from other parts of England. I imagined it was one of them."
"There wasn't a divorce, then?"
"Helen didn't want a divorce. Kelvin told me that. That's why I imagined, perhaps wrongly,
that it was a case of some married man. Someone whose wife was an R.C., perhaps.
And my father?
He didn't want a divorce, either.
Dr. Kennedy spoke rather shortly. Tell me about my father, said Gwenda. Why did he decide suddenly to send me out to New Zealand?
Kennedy paused a moment before saying, I gather your people out there had been pressing him. After the breakup of his second marriage, he probably thought it was the best thing.
Why didn't he take me out there himself?
Dr. Kennedy looked along the mantelpiece, searching vaguely for a pipe cleaner. Oh, I don't know. He was in rather poor health.
What was the matter with him? What did he die of?
The door opened, and the scornful housekeeper appeared with a laden tray. There was buttered toast and some jam, but no cake. With a vague gesture, Dr. Kennedy motioned Gwenda to pour out. She did so. When the cups were filled and handed round, and Gwenda had taken a piece of toast, Dr. Kennedy said with rather forced cheerfulness, Tell me what you've done to the house. I don't suppose I'd recognize it now, after you two have finished with it.
We're having a little fun with the bathrooms, admitted Giles.
Gwenda, her eyes on the doctor, said, What did my father die of?
I couldn't really tell, my dear. As I say, he was in rather poor health for a while, and he finally went into a sanatorium, somewhere on the East Coast. He died about 2 years later.
Where was this sanatorium, exactly?
I'm sorry. I can't remember now. As I say, I have an impression it was on the East Coast.
There was a definite evasion now in his manner. Giles and Gwenda looked at each other for a brief second. Giles said, At least, sir, you can tell us where he's buried. Gwenda is naturally very anxious to visit his grave.
Dr. Kennedy bent over the fireplace, scraping in the bowl of his pipe with a penknife.
"'Do you know,' he said, rather indistinctly, "'I don't really think I should dwell too much on the past. "'All this ancestor worship, it's a mistake. "'The future is what matters. "'Here you are, you two, young and healthy, with the world in front of you. "'Think forward. "'No use going about putting flowers on the grave of someone whom, "'for all practical purposes, you hardly knew.'
"'Gwenda said mutinously, "'I should like to see my father's grave.'
I'm afraid I can't help you.
Dr. Kennedy's tones were pleasant, but cold.
It's a long time ago, and my memory isn't what it was. I lost touch with your father after he left Dilmouth. I think he wrote to me once from the sanatorium, and, as I say, I have an impression it was on the East Coast, but I couldn't really be sure even of that, and I've no idea at all of where he is buried.
How very odd, said Giles.
Not really. The link between us, you see, was Helen. I was always very fond of Helen. She's my half-sister, and very many years younger than I am, but I tried to bring her up as well as I could, the right schools and all that. But there's no gainsaying that Helen, well, that she never had a stable character. There was trouble when she was quite young, with a very undesirable young man. I got her out of that safely. Then she elected to go out to India and marry Walter Fane. Well, that was all right, nice lad. Son of Dilmouth's leading solicitor, but frankly, dull as ditch-water. He'd always adored her, but she'd never looked at him. Still, she changed her mind and went out to India to marry him. When she saw him again, it was all off. She wired to me for money for her passage home. I sent it. On the way back, she met Kelvin. They were married before I knew about it. I felt, shall we say, apologetic for that sister of mine. It explains why Kelvin and I didn't keep up the relationship after she went away. He added suddenly, Where's Helen now? Can you tell me? I'd like to get in touch with her.
But we don't know, said Gwenda. We don't know at all.
Oh, I thought from your advertisement. He looked at them with sudden curiosity. Tell me, why did you advertise?
Gwenda said, We wanted to get in touch,
and stopped. With someone you can hardly remember?
Dr. Kennedy looked puzzled. Gwenda said quickly, I thought if I could get in touch with her, she'd tell me about my father.
Yes, yes, I see. Well, sorry, I can't be of much use. Memory, not what it was, and it's a long time ago.
At least, said Giles, you know what kind of a sanatorium it was. Tubercular?
Dr. Kennedy's face again looked suddenly wooden. Yes, yes, I rather believe it was. "Then we ought to be able to trace that quite easily," said Giles. "Thank you very much, sir, for all you've told us." He got up, and Gwenda followed suit.
"Thank you very much," she said, "and do come and see us at Hillside."
They went out of the room, and Gwenda, glancing back over her shoulder, had a final view of Dr. Kennedy standing by the mantelpiece, pulling his grizzled moustache and looking troubled.
"He knows something he won't tell us," said Gwenda, as they got into the car. "There's something. Oh, Giles, I wish now that we'd never started."
They looked at each other, and in each mind, unacknowledged to the other, the same fear sprang.
"Miss Marple was right," said Gwenda. "We should have left the past alone."
"We needn't go any further," said Giles uncertainly. "I think, perhaps, Gwenda, darling, we'd better not." Gwenda shook her head.
"No, Giles, we can't stop now. We should always be wondering and imagining. No, we've got to go on. Dr. Kennedy wouldn't tell us because he wanted to be kind, but that sort of business is no good. We'll have to go on and find out what really happened, even if it was my father who..."
But she couldn't go on.
Chapter 8. Kelvin Halliday's Delusion.
They were in the garden on the following morning when Mrs. Cocker came out and said, "Excuse me, sir, there's a Dr. Kennedy on the telephone."
Leaving Gwenda in consultation with old Foster, Giles went into the house and picked up the telephone receiver.
"Giles Reed here." "This is Dr. Kennedy. I've been thinking over our conversation yesterday, Mr. Reed. There are certain facts which I think perhaps you and your wife ought to know. Will you be at home if I come over this afternoon?"
"Certainly we shall. What time?"
3 o'clock.
"Suits us."
In the garden, old Foster said to Gwenda, "Is that Dr. Kennedy as used to live over at Westcliff?"
"I expect so. Did you know him?"
"He was always reckoned to be best doctor here. Not but what Dr. Lazenby wasn't more popular. Always had a word and a laugh to jolly you along, Dr. Lazenby did. Dr. Kennedy was always a bit short and a bit dry-like, but he knew his job."
"When did he give up his practice?"
"Long time ago now. Must be 15 years or so. His health broke down, so they say."
Giles came out of the window and answered Gwenda's unspoken question.
"He's coming over this afternoon."
"Oh."
She turned once more to Foster.
"Did you know Dr. Kennedy's sister at all?"
"Sister? Oh, not as I remember. She was only a bit of a lass. Went away to school and then abroad, though I heard she'd come back here for a bit after she married. But I believe she run off with some chap. All as wild she was, they said. Don't know as I ever laid eyes on her myself. I was on a job over to Plymouth for a while, you know."
Gwenda said to Giles as they walked to the end of the terrace,
"Why is he coming?"
"We'll know at 3 o'clock.
Dr. Kennedy arrived punctually. Looking around the drawing room, he said,
"Seems odd to be here again."
Then he came to the point without preamble.
"I take it that you two are quite determined to track down the sanatorium where Kelvin Halliday died and learn all the details you can about his illness and death?"
"Definitely," said Gwenda.
"Well, you can manage that quite easily, of course. So I've come to the conclusion that it will be less shock to you to hear the facts from me. I'm sorry to have to tell you, for it won't do you or anybody else a bit of good, and will probably cause you, Gwenny, a great deal of pain, but there it is. Your father wasn't suffering from tuberculosis, and the sanatorium in question was a mental home."
"A mental home? Was he out of his mind, then?"
Gwenda's face had gone very white. "He was never certified, and in my opinion, he was not insane in the general meaning of the term. He had had a very severe nervous breakdown and suffered from certain delusional obsessions. He went into the nursing home of his own will and volition, and could, of course, have left it any time he wanted to. His condition did not improve, however, and he died there."
"Delusional obsessions?"
Giles repeated the words questioningly.
"What kind of delusions?"
Dr. Kennedy said dryly,
"He was under the impression that he had strangled his wife."
Gwenda
gave a stifled cry. Giles stretched out a hand quickly and took her cold hand in his. Giles said, And had he? Eh?
Dr. Kennedy stared at him.
No, of course he hadn't. No question of such a thing.
But how do you know?
Gwenda's voice came uncertainly.
My dear child, there was never any question of such a thing. Helen left him for another man. He'd been in a very unbalanced condition for some time. Nervous dreams, sick fancies. The final shock sent him over the edge. I'm not a psychiatrist myself. They have their explanations for such matters. If a man would rather his wife was dead than unfaithful, he can manage to make himself believe that she is dead, even that he has killed her.
Warily, Giles and Gwenda exchanged a warning glance. Giles said quietly, So you are quite sure that there was no question of his having actually done what he said he had done?
Oh, quite sure. I had two letters from Helen, the first one from France about a week after she went away, and one about 6 months later. Oh, no. The whole thing was a delusion, pure and simple.
Gwenda drew a deep breath.
Please, she said, will you tell me all about it?
I'll tell you everything I can, my dear.
To begin with, Kelvin had been in a rather peculiar neurotic state for some time. He came to me about it, said he had had various disquieting dreams. These dreams, he said, were always the same, and they ended in the same way, with his throttling Helen. I tried to get at the root of the trouble. There must, I think, have been some conflict in early childhood. His father and mother apparently were not a happy couple. Well, I won't go into all that. That's only interesting to a medical man. I actually suggested that Kelvin should consult a psychiatrist. There are several first-class chaps. But he wouldn't hear of it. Thought that kind of thing was all nonsense. I had an idea that he and Helen weren't getting along too well, but he never spoke about that, and I didn't like to ask questions. The whole thing came to a head when he walked into my house one evening. It was a Friday, I remember. I'd just come back from the hospital and found him waiting for me in the consulting room. He'd been there about a quarter of an hour. As soon as I came in, he looked up and said, I've killed Helen. For a moment, I didn't know what to think. He was so cool and matter-of-fact. I said, You mean you've had another dream? He said, It isn't a dream this time, it's true. She's lying there strangled. I strangled her. Then, he said, quite coolly and reasonably, You'd better come back with me to the house. Then you can ring up the police from there. I didn't know what to think. I got out the car again, and we drove along here. The house was quiet and dark. We went up to the bedroom.
Gwenda broke in. The bedroom?
Her voice held pure astonishment. Dr. Kennedy looked faintly surprised. Yes. Yes, that's where it all happened. Well, of course, when we got up there, there was nothing at all. No dead woman lying across the bed. Nothing disturbed, the coverlets not even rumpled. The whole thing had been an hallucination.
But what did my father say?
Oh, he persisted in his story, of course. He really believed it, you see. I persuaded him to let me give him a sedative, and I put him to bed in the dressing room. Then I had a good look round. I found a note that Helen had left, crumpled up in the waste paper basket in the drawing room. It was quite clear. She had written something like this. This is goodbye. I'm sorry, but our marriage has been a mistake from the beginning. I'm going away with the only man I've ever loved. Forgive me if you can, Helen. Evidently, Kelvin had come in, read her note, gone upstairs, had a kind of emotional brainstorm, and had then come over to me, persuaded that he had killed Helen. Then I questioned the housemaid. It was her evening out, and she'd come in late. I took her into Helen's room, and she went through Helen's clothes, etc. It was all quite clear. Helen had packed a suitcase and a bag, and had taken them away with her. I searched the house, but there was no trace of anything unusual, certainly no sign of a strangled woman. I had a very difficult time with Kelvin in the morning. But he realized at last that it was a delusion, or at least he said he did, and he consented to go into a nursing home for treatment. A week later I got, as I say, a letter from Helen. It was posted from Biarritz, but she said she was going on to Spain. I was to tell Kelvin that she did not want a divorce. He had better forget her as soon as possible.
I showed the letter to Kelvin. He said very little. He was going ahead with his plans. He wired out to his first wife's people in New Zealand, asking them to take the child. He settled up his affairs, and he then entered a very good private mental home and consented to have appropriate treatment. That treatment, however, did nothing to help him. He died there 2 years later. I can give you the address of the place. It's in Norfolk. The present superintendent was a young doctor there at the time, and will probably be able to give you full details of your father's case. Gwenda said, "And you got another letter from your sister? After that again?" "Oh, yes. About 6 months later. She wrote from Florence, gave an address post-restant as Miss Kennedy. She said she realized that perhaps it was unfair to Kelvin not to have a divorce, though she herself did not want one. If he wanted a divorce, and I would let her know, she would see that he had the necessary evidence. I took the letter to Kelvin. He said at once that he did not want a divorce. I wrote to her and told her so. Since then, I have never heard any more. I don't know where she is living, or indeed if she is alive or dead. That is why I was attracted by your advertisement, and hoped that I should get news of her." He added gently, "I'm very sorry about this, Gwenny, but you had to know. I only wish you could have left well alone." Chapter 9. Unknown Factor. When Giles came back from seeing Dr. Kennedy off, he found Gwenda sitting where he had left her. There was a bright red patch on each of her cheeks, and her eyes looked feverish. When she spoke, her voice was harsh and brittle. "What's the old catchphrase? Death or madness, either way? That's what this is. Death or madness." "Gwenda, darling." Giles went to her, put his arm round her. Her body felt hard and stiff. "Why didn't we leave it all alone? Why didn't we? It was my own father who strangled her. And it was my own father's voice I heard saying those words. No wonder it all came back. No wonder I was so frightened. My own father."
"Wait, Gwenda, wait. We don't really know."
"Of course we know. He told Dr. Kennedy he had strangled his wife, didn't he? But Kennedy is quite positive he didn't, because he didn't find a body. But there was a body, and I saw it."
"You saw it in the hall, not the bedroom."
"What difference does that make?"
"Well, it's queer, isn't it? Why should Halliday say he strangled his wife in the bedroom if he actually strangled her in the hall?"
"Oh, I don't know. It's just a minor detail."
"Well, I'm not so sure. Pull your socks up, darling. There are some very funny points about the whole setup. We'll take it, if you like, that your father did strangle Helen in the hall. What happened next?"
"He went off to Dr. Kennedy and told him he had strangled his wife in the bedroom, brought him back with him, and there was no body in the hall or in the bedroom."
"Well, dash it all, there can't be a murder without a body. What had he done with the body?"
"Well, perhaps there was one, and Dr. Kennedy helped him and hushed it all up. Only, of course, he couldn't tell us that."
Giles shook his head. "No, Gwenda, I don't see Kennedy acting that way. He's a hard-headed, shrewd, unemotional Scotsman. You're suggesting that he'd be willing to put himself in jeopardy as an accessory after the fact. I don't believe he would. He'd do his best for Halliday by giving evidence as to his mental state. That, yes. But why should he stick his neck out to hush the whole thing up? Kelvin Halliday wasn't any relation to him, nor a close friend. It was his own sister who had been killed, and he was clearly fond of her, even if he did show slight Victorian disapproval of her gay ways. It's not even as though you were his sister's child." "No. Kennedy wouldn't connive at concealing murder. If he did, there's only one possible way he could have set about it, and that would be deliberately to give a death certificate that she had died of heart failure or something. I suppose he might have got away with that, but we know definitely that he didn't do that, because there's no record of her death in the parish registers, and if he had done it, he would have told us that his sister had died. So, go on from there and explain, if you can, what happened to the body.
Perhaps my father buried it somewhere, in the garden?
And then went to Kennedy and told him he'd murdered his wife? Why? Why not rely on the story that she'd left him? Gwenda pushed back her hair from her forehead. She was less stiff and rigid now, and the patches of sharp colour were fading.
I don't know, she admitted. It does seem a bit screwy now that you put it that way. Do you think Dr. Kennedy was telling us the truth?
Oh, yes, I'm pretty sure of it. From his point of view, it's a perfectly reasonable story. Dreams, hallucinations, finally, a major hallucination. He's got no doubt that it was an hallucination, because, as we've just said, you can't have a murder without a body. And that's where we're in a different position from him. We know that there was a body. He paused and went on. From his point of view, everything fits in. Missing clothes and suitcase, the farewell note, and later two letters from his sister.
Gwenda stirred. Those letters, how do we explain those?
We don't, but we've got to. If we assume that Kennedy was telling us the truth, and as I say, I'm pretty sure that he was, we've got to explain those letters.
I suppose they really were in his sister's handwriting? He recognised it?
You know, Gwenda, I don't believe that point would arise. It's not like a signature on a doubtful cheque. If those letters were written in a reasonably close imitation of his sister's writing, it wouldn't occur to him to doubt them. He'd already got the preconceived idea that she's gone away with someone. The letters just confirmed that belief. If he'd never heard from her at all, why then he might have got suspicious. All the same, there are certain curious points about those letters that wouldn't strike him, perhaps, but do strike me. They are strangely anonymous. No address, except a poste restante. No indication of who the man in the case was. A clearly stated determination to make a clean break with all old ties. What I mean is, they're exactly the kind of letters a murderer would devise if he wanted to allay any suspicions on the part of his victim's family. It's the old Crippen touch again. To get the letters posted from abroad would be easy.
You think my father...
No, that's just it. I don't. Take a man who's deliberately decided to get rid of his wife. He spreads rumours about her possible unfaithfulness. He stages her departure. Note left behind, clothes packed and taken. Letters will be received from her at carefully spaced intervals from somewhere abroad. Actually, he has murdered her quietly and put her, say, under the cellar floor. That's one pattern of murder, and it's often been done. But what that type of murderer doesn't do is to rush to his brother-in-law and say he's murdered his wife and hadn't they better go to the police. On the other hand, if your father was the emotional type of killer, and was terribly in love with his wife, and strangled her in a fit of frenzied jealousy, Othello fashion, and that fits in with the words you heard, he certainly doesn't pack clothes and arrange for letters to come before he rushes off to broadcast his crime to a man who isn't the type likely to hush it up. It's all wrong, Gwenda. The whole pattern is wrong.
Then what are you trying to get at, Giles?
I don't know. It's just that throughout it all, there seems to be an unknown factor. Call him X, someone who hasn't appeared as yet, but one gets glimpses of his technique.
X, said Gwenda wonderingly.
Then her eyes darkened.
You're making that up, Giles, to comfort me.
I swear I'm not. Don't you see yourself that you can't make a satisfactory outline to fit all the facts? We know that Helen Halliday was strangled because you saw... He stopped.
Good Lord! I've been a fool! I see it now. It covers everything. You're right.
And Kennedy's right, too. Listen, Gwenda. Helen's preparing to go away with a lover. Who that is, we don't know.
X?
Giles brushed her interpolation aside impatiently. She's written her note to her husband. But at that moment, he comes in. Reads what she's writing and goes haywire. He crumbles up the note, slings it into the wastebasket and goes for her. She's terrified, rushes out into the hall. He catches up with her, throttles her. She goes limp and he drops her. And then,
Standing a little way from her, he quotes those words from the Duchess of Malfi, just as the child upstairs has reached the banisters and is peering down. And after that? The point is that she isn't dead. He may have thought she was dead, but she's merely semi-suffocated. Perhaps a lover comes round, after the frantic husband has started for the doctor's house on the other side of the town, or perhaps she regains consciousness by herself. Anyway, as soon as she has come to, she beats it quickly, and that explains everything. Kelvin's belief that he has killed her, the disappearance of the clothes, packed and taken away earlier in the day, and the subsequent letters which are perfectly genuine. There you are. That explains everything. Gwenda said slowly, "It doesn't explain why Kelvin said he had strangled her in the bedroom." "Why, he was so het up, he couldn't quite remember where it had all happened." Gwenda said, "I'd like to believe you. I want to believe. But I go on feeling sure, quite sure, that when I looked down, she was dead, quite dead." "But how could you possibly tell? A child of barely three." She looked at him queerly. "I think one can tell, better than if one was older. It's like dogs. They know death and throw back their heads and howl. I think children know death." "That's nonsense. That's fantastic." The ring of the doorbell interrupted him. He said, "Who's that, I wonder?" Gwenda looked dismayed. "Oh, I quite forgot. It's Miss Marple. I asked her to tea today. Don't let's say anything about all this to her." Gwenda was afraid that tea might prove a difficult meal, but Miss Marple fortunately seemed not to notice that her hostess talked a little too fast and too feverishly, and that her gaiety was somewhat forced. Miss Marple herself was gently garrulous. She was enjoying her stay in Dilmouth so much, and wasn't it exciting? Some friends of hers had written to friends of theirs in Dilmouth, and as a result she had received some very pleasant invitations from the local residents. One feels so much less of an outsider, if you know what I mean, my dear, if one gets to know some of the people who have been established here for years. For instance, I am going to tea with Mrs. Fane. She is the widow of the senior partner in the best firm of solicitors here. Quite an old-fashioned family firm. Her son is carrying it on now." The gentle, gossiping voice went on. Her landlady was so kind, and had made her so comfortable, and really delicious cooking. She was for some years with my old friend Mrs. Bantry, although she does not come from this part of the world herself. Her aunt lived here for many years, and she and her husband used to come here for holidays, so she knows a great deal of the local gossip. Do you find your gardener satisfactory, by the way? I hear that he is considered locally as rather a scrimshanker, more talk than work." "Talk and tea is his speciality," said Giles. "He has about 5 cups of tea a day, but he works splendidly when we're looking." "Come out and see the garden," said Gwenda. They showed her the house and the garden, and Miss Marple made the proper comments. If Gwenda had feared her shrewd observation of something amiss, then Gwenda was wrong, for Miss Marple showed no cognizance of anything unusual. Yet, strangely enough, it was Gwenda who acted in an unpredictable manner. She interrupted Miss Marple in the midst of a little anecdote about a child in a seashell to say breathlessly to Giles, I don't care. I'm going to tell her." Miss Marple turned her head attentively. Giles started to speak, then stopped. Finally he said, "Well, it's your funeral, Gwenda." And so Gwenda poured it all out. Their call on Dr. Kennedy, and his subsequent call on them, and what he had told them. "That was what you meant in London, wasn't it?" Gwenda asked breathlessly. "You thought then that my father might be involved?" Miss Marple said gently, "It occurred to me as a possibility, yes. Helen might very well be a young stepmother, and in a case of strangling, it is so often a husband who is involved." Miss Marple spoke as one who observes natural phenomena without surprise or emotion.
"'I do see why you urged us to leave it alone,' said Gwenda. "'Oh, and I wish now we had. "'But one can't go back.'
"'No,' said Miss Marple. "'One can't go back.'
"'And now you'd better listen to Giles. "'He's been making objections and suggestions.'
"'All I say is,' said Giles, "'that it doesn't fit.' "'And lucidly, clearly, he went over the points "'as he had previously outlined them to Gwenda.' Then he particularized his final theory. If you'll only convince Gwenda that that's the only way it could have been.
Miss Marple's eyes went from him to Gwenda and back again.
It is a perfectly reasonable hypothesis, she said. But there is always, as you yourself pointed out, Mr. Reed, the possibility of X.
X, said Gwenda.
The unknown factor, said Miss Marple. Someone, shall we say, who hasn't appeared yet, but whose presence, behind the obvious facts, can be deduced.
"'We are going to the sanatorium in Norfolk where my father died,' said Gwenda. "'Perhaps we'll find out something there.'
Chapter 10 A Case History Saltmarsh House was set pleasantly about 6 miles inland from the coast. It had a good train service to London, from the 5 miles distant town of South Benham. Giles and Gwenda were shown into a large, airy sitting-room with cretonne covers, patterned with flowers. A very charming-looking old lady with white hair came into the room, holding a glass of milk. She nodded to them and sat down near the fireplace. Her eyes rested thoughtfully on Gwenda, and presently she leaned forward towards her and spoke in what was almost a whisper.
"'Is it your poor child, my dear?'
Gwenda looked slightly taken aback. She said doubtfully, "'No, no, it isn't.'
"'Ah, I wondered.'
The old lady nodded her head and sipped her milk. Then she said conversationally,
"'Half-past 10, that's the time. It's always at 10:30. Most remarkable.'
She lowered her voice and leaned forward again.
"'Behind the fireplace,' she breathed. "'But don't say I told you.'
At this moment a white uniformed maid came into the room and requested Giles and Gwenda to follow her. They were shown into Dr. Penrose's study, and Dr. Penrose rose to greet them. Dr. Penrose, Gwenda could not help thinking, looked a little mad himself. He looked, for instance, much madder than the nice old lady in the drawing-room. But perhaps psychiatrists always looked a little mad.
"'I had your letter and Dr. Kennedy's,' said Dr. Penrose. "'And I've been looking up your father's case history, Mrs. Reed. "'I remember his case quite well, of course, "'but I wanted to refresh my memory "'so that I should be in a position to tell you everything you wanted to know. "'I understand that you have only recently become aware of the facts?'
"'Gwenda explained that she had been brought up in New Zealand "'by her mother's relations, "'and that all she had known about her father "'was that he had died in a nursing home in England.' "'Dr. Penrose nodded. "'Quite so.'
Your father's case, Mrs. Reed, presented certain rather peculiar features.
Such as? Giles asked.
Well, the obsession or delusion was very strong. Major Halliday, though clearly in a very nervous state, was most emphatic and categorical in his assertion that he had strangled his second wife in a fit of jealous rage. A great many of the usual signs in these cases were absent, and I don't mind telling you frankly, Mrs. Reed, that had it not been for Dr. Kennedy's assurance that Mrs. Halliday was actually alive, I should have been prepared at that time to take your father's assertion at its face value.
You formed the impression that he had actually killed her? Giles asked.
I said at that time. Later, I had cause to revise my opinion, as Major Halliday's character and mental makeup became more familiar to me.
Your father, Mrs. Reed, was most definitely not a paranoiac type. He had no delusions of persecution, no impulses of violence. He was a gentle, kindly, and well-controlled individual. He was neither what the world calls mad, nor was he dangerous to others. But he did have this obstinate fixation about Mrs. Halliday's death, and to account for its origin, I am quite convinced we have to go back a long way, to some
childish experience. But I admit that all the methods of analysis failed to give us the right clue. Breaking down a patient's resistance to analysis is sometimes a very long business. It may take several years. In your father's case, the time was insufficient. He paused, and then, looking up sharply, said, "You know, I presume, that Major Halliday committed suicide?"
"Oh, no!" cried Gwenda.
"I'm sorry, Mrs. Reed. I thought you knew that. You are entitled, perhaps, to attach some blame to us on that account. I admit that proper vigilance would have prevented it, but frankly I saw no sign of Major Halliday's being a suicidal type. He showed no tendency to melancholia, no brooding or despondency. He complained of sleeplessness, and my colleague allowed him a certain amount of sleeping tablets. Whilst pretending to take them, he actually kept them until he had accumulated a sufficient amount, and he spread out his hands.
Was he so dreadfully unhappy?"
"No, I do not think so. It was more, I should judge, a guilt complex, a desire for a penalty to be exacted. He had insisted at first, you know, on calling in the police, and though persuaded out of that, and assured that he had actually committed no crime at all, he obstinately refused to be wholly convinced. Yet it was proved to him over and over again, and he had to admit that he had no recollection of committing the actual act." Dr. Penrose ruffled over the papers in front of him. "His account of the evening in question never varied. He came into the house, he said, and it was dark. The servants were out. He went into the dining room, as he usually did, poured himself out a drink and drank it, then went through the connecting door into the drawing room. After that, he remembered nothing, nothing at all, until he was standing in his bedroom, looking down at his wife who was dead, strangled. He knew he had done it." Giles interrupted. "Excuse me, Dr. Penrose, but why did he know he had done it?" "There was no doubt in his mind. For some months past, he had found himself entertaining wild and melodramatic suspicions. He told me, for instance, that he had been convinced his wife was administering drugs to him. He had, of course, lived in India, and the practice of wives driving their husbands insane by datura poisoning often comes up there in the native courts. He had suffered fairly often from hallucinations with confusion of time and place. He denied strenuously that he suspected his wife of infidelity, but nevertheless, I think that that was the motivating power. It seems that what actually occurred was that he went into the drawing-room, read the note his wife left, saying she was leaving him, and that his way of eluding this fact was to prefer to kill her. Hence the hallucination."
"You mean he cared for her very much?" asked Gwenda.
"Obviously, Mrs. Reed."
"And he never recognized that it was an hallucination?"
"He had to acknowledge that it must be, but his inner belief remained unshaken. The obsession was too strong to yield to reason. If we could have uncovered the underlying childish fixation..." Gwenda interrupted. She was uninterested in childish fixations.
"But you're quite sure, you say, that he didn't do it?"
"Oh, if that is what is worrying you, Mrs. Reed, you can put it right out of your head. Kelvin Halliday, however jealous he may have been of his wife, was emphatically not a killer." Dr. Penrose coughed and picked up a small, shabby black book. "If you would like this, Mrs. Reed, you are the proper person to have it. It contains various jottings set down by your father during the time he was here. When we turned over his effects to his executor, actually a firm of solicitors, Dr. Maguire, who was then superintendent, retained this as part of the case history. Your father's case, you know, appears in Dr. Maguire's book, only under initials, of course, Mr. K.H. If you would like this diary..." Gwenda stretched out her hand eagerly.
"Thank you," she said. "I should like it very much."
In the train on the way back to London, Gwenda took out the shabby little black book and began to read. She opened it at random. Kelvin Halliday had written,
I suppose these Dr. Wallers know their business. It all sounds such poppycock. Was I in love with my mother? Did I hate my father? I don't believe a word of it. I can't help feeling this is a simple police case, criminal court, not a crazy loony bin matter. And yet, some of these people here, so natural, so reasonable, just like everyone else, except when you suddenly come across the kink. Very well, then, it seems that I, too, have a kink. I've written to James, urged him to communicate with Helen. Let her come and see me in the flesh if she's alive. He says he doesn't know where she is. That's because he knows that she's dead and that I killed her. He's a good fellow, but I'm not deceived. Helen is dead. When did I begin to suspect her? A long time ago. Soon after we came to Dilmouth. Her manner changed. She was concealing something. I used to watch her. Yes, and she used to watch me. Did she give me drugs in my food? Those queer, awful nightmares. Not ordinary dreams. Living nightmares. I know it was drugs. Only she could have done that. Why? There's some man. Some man she was afraid of. Let me be honest. I suspected, didn't I, that she had a lover? There was someone. I know there was someone. She said as much to me on the boat. Someone she loved and couldn't marry. It was the same for both of us. I couldn't forget Megan. How like Megan little Gwenny looks sometimes. Helen played with Gwenny so sweetly on the boat. Helen, you are so lovely. Helen. Is Helen alive? Or did I put my hands round her throat and choke the life out of her? I went through the dining room door, and I saw the note propped up on the desk, and then, all black. Just blackness. But there's no doubt about it. I killed her. Thank God Gwenny's all right in New Zealand. They're good people. They'll love her for Megan's sake. Megan. Megan. How I wish you were here. It's the best way. No scandal. The best way for the child. I can't go on. Not year after year. I must take the short way out. Gwenny will never know anything about all this. She'll never know her father was a murderer. Tears blinded Gwenda's eyes. She looked across at Giles sitting opposite her. But Giles' eyes were riveted on the opposite corner. Aware of Gwenda's scrutiny, he motioned faintly with his head. Their fellow passenger was reading an evening paper. On the outside of it, clearly presented to their view, was a melodramatic caption. Who were the men in her life? Slowly, Gwenda nodded her head. She looked down at the diary. There was someone. I know there was someone. Chapter 11 The Men in Her Life. Miss Marple crossed Sea Parade and walked along 4th Street, turning up the hill by the arcade. The shops here were the old-fashioned ones, a woolen art needlework shop, a confectioner, a Victorian-looking ladies outfitter and draper, and others of the same kind. Miss Marple looked in at the window of the art needlework shop. Two young assistants were engaged with customers, but an elderly woman at the back of the shop was free. Miss Marple pushed open the door and went in. She seated herself at the counter, and the assistant, a pleasant woman with grey hair, said, "What can I do for you, madam?" Miss Marple wanted some pale blue wool to knit a baby's jacket. The proceedings were leisurely and unhurried. Patterns were discussed. Miss Marple looked through various children's knitting books, and in the course of it discussed her great-nephews and nieces. Neither she nor the assistant displayed impatience. The assistant had attended to customers such as Miss Marple for many years. She preferred these gentle, gossipy, rambling old ladies to the impatient, rather impolite young mothers who didn't know what they wanted and had an eye for the cheap and showy. "Yes," said Miss Marple, "I think that will be very nice indeed, and I always find stork leg so reliable. It really doesn't shrink.
I think I'll take an extra 2 ounces. The assistant remarked that the wind was very cold today as she wrapped up the parcel. Yes, indeed, I noticed it as I was coming along the front. Dilmouth has changed a good deal. I have not been here for, let me see, nearly 19 years.
Indeed, madam, then you will find a lot of changes. The Superb wasn't built then, I suppose, nor the Southview Hotel.
Oh, no, it was quite a small place. I was staying with friends. A house called St. Catherine's, perhaps you know it, on the Leehampton Road.
But the assistant had only been in Dilmouth a matter of 10 years.
Miss Marple thanked her, took the parcel, and went into the draper's next door. Here again she selected an elderly assistant. The conversation ran much on the same lines, to the accompaniment of summer vests. This time the assistant responded promptly.
Oh, that would be Mrs. Findison's house.
Yes, yes. Though the friends I knew had it furnished, a Major Halliday and his wife and a baby girl.
Oh, yes, madam. They had it for about a year, I think.
Yes, he was home from India. They had a very good cook. She gave me a wonderful recipe for baked apple pudding, and also, I think, for gingerbread. I often wonder what became of her.
I expect you mean Edith Paget, madam. She's still in Dilmouth. She's in service now at Windrush Lodge.
Then there were some other people. The Fanes, a lawyer, I think he was.
Oh, old Mr. Fane died some years ago. Young Mr. Fane, Mr. Walter Fane, lives with his mother. Mr. Walter Fane never married. He's the senior partner now.
Indeed. I had an idea Mr. Walter Fane had gone out to India, tea planting or something.
I believe he did, madam, as a young man, but he came home and went into the firm after about a year or two. They do all the best business round here. They're very highly thought of. A very nice, quiet gentleman, Mr. Walter Fane. Everybody likes him.
Why, of course, exclaimed Miss Marple. He was engaged to Miss Kennedy, wasn't he? And then she broke it off and married Major Halliday.
That's right, madam. She went out to India to marry Mr. Fane, but it seems that she changed her mind and married the other gentleman instead.
A faintly disapproving note had entered the assistant's voice. Miss Marple leaned forward and lowered her voice.
I was always so sorry for poor Major Halliday. I knew his mother and his little girl. I understand his second wife left him, ran away with someone, a rather flighty type, I'm afraid.
Regular flibbertigibbet she was, and her brother the doctor such a nice man. Did my rheumatic knee a world of good.
Whom did she run away with? I never heard.
Oh, that I couldn't tell you, madam. Some said it was one of the summer visitors, but I know Major Halliday was quite broken up. He left the place, and I believe his health gave way. Your change, madam.
Miss Marple accepted her change and her parcel.
Thank you so much, she said. I wonder if Edith Paget, did you say, still has that nice recipe for gingerbread. I lost it, or rather my careless maid lost it, and I'm so fond of good gingerbread.
I expect so, madam. As a matter of fact, her sister lives next door here, married to Mr. Mountford, the confectioner. Edith usually comes there on her days out, and I'm sure Mrs. Mountford would give her a message.
Oh, that's a very good idea. Thank you so much for all the trouble you've taken.
A pleasure, madam, I assure you.
Miss Marple went out into the street.
A nice old-fashioned firm, she said to herself, and those vests are really very nice, so it isn't as though I had wasted any money.
She glanced at the pale blue enamel watch that she wore pinned to one side of her dress. Just 5 minutes to go before meeting those two young things at the Ginger Cat. I hope they didn't find things too upsetting at the sanatorium. Giles and Gwenda sat together at a corner table at the Ginger Cat. The little black notebook lay on the table between them. Miss Marple came in from the street and joined them.
What will you have, Miss Marple? Coffee? Yes, thank you. No, not cakes, just a scone and butter.
Giles gave the order, and Gwenda pushed the little black book across to Miss Marple.
First, you must read that, she said, and then we can talk. It's what my father, what he wrote himself when he was at the nursing home. Oh, but first of all, just tell Miss Marple exactly what Dr. Penrose said, Giles.
Giles did so. Then Miss Marple opened the little black book, and the waitress brought 3 cups of weak coffee and a scone and butter and a plate of cakes. Giles and Gwenda did not talk. They watched Miss Marple as she read. Finally, she closed the book and laid it down. Her expression was difficult to read. There was, Gwenda thought, anger in it. Her lips were pressed tightly together, and her eyes shone very brightly, unusually so, considering her age. "Yes, indeed," she said. "Yes, indeed." Gwenda said, "You advised us once, do you remember, not to go on?" "I can see why you did, but we did go on, and this is where we've got to. Only now it seems as though we've got to another place where one could, if one liked, stop. Do you think we ought to stop, or not?" Miss Marple shook her head slowly. She seemed worried, perplexed. "I don't know," she said. "I really don't know. It might be better to do so, much better to do so, because after this lapse of time there is nothing that you can do, nothing, I mean, of a constructive nature." "You mean that after this lapse of time there is nothing we can find out?" asked Giles. "Oh, no," said Miss Marple. "I didn't mean that at all. 19 years is not such a long time. There are people who would remember things, who could answer questions, quite a lot of people. Servants, for instance. There must have been at least 2 servants in the house at the time, and a nurse, and probably a gardener. It will only take time and a little trouble to find and talk to these people. As a matter of fact, I found one of them already." "The cook?" "No, it wasn't that. It was more the question of what practical good you can accomplish, and I'd be inclined to say to that, none. And yet..." She stopped. "There is a yet. I'm a little slow in thinking things out, but I have a feeling that there is something perhaps not very tangible, that should be worth taking risks for, even that one should take risks for, but I find it difficult to say just what that is." Giles began, "It seems to me..." and stopped. Miss Marple turned to him gratefully. "Gentlemen," she said, "always seem to be able to tabulate things so clearly. I'm sure you have thought things out." "I've been thinking things out," said Giles, "and it seems to me that there are just 2 conclusions one can come to. One is the same as I suggested before. Helen Halliday wasn't dead when Gwenny saw her lying in the hall. She came to and went away with her lover, whoever he was. That would still fit the facts as we know them. It would square with Kelvin Halliday's rooted belief that he had killed his wife. And it would square with the missing suitcase and clothes, and with the note that Dr. Kennedy found. But it leaves certain points unaccounted for. It doesn't explain why Kelvin was convinced he strangled his wife in his bedroom. And it doesn't cover the one, to my mind, really staggering question. Where is Helen Halliday now? Because it seems to me, against all reason, that Helen should never have been heard of or from again. Grant that the 2 letters she wrote are genuine, what happened after that? Why did she never write again? She was on affectionate terms with her brother. He's obviously deeply attached to her and always has been. He might disapprove of her conduct, but that doesn't mean that he expected never to hear from her again. And if you ask me, that point has obviously been worrying Kennedy himself. Let's say he accepted at the time absolutely the story he's told us. His sister's going off and Kelvin's breakdown. But he didn't expect never to hear from his sister again. I think, as the years went on and he didn't hear, and Kelvin Halliday persisted in his delusion and finally committed suicide, that a terrible doubt began to creep up in his mind. Supposing that Kelvin's story was true, that he actually had killed Helen. There's no word from her. And surely, if she had died somewhere abroad, word would have come to him. I think that explains his eagerness when he saw our advertisement. He hoped that it might lead to some account of where she was or what she'd been doing. I'm sure it's absolutely unnatural for someone to disappear as completely as Helen seems to have done. That in itself is highly suspicious. I agree with you, said Miss Marple, but the alternative, Mr. Reed... Giles said slowly,
I've been thinking out the alternative. It's pretty fantastic, you know, and even rather frightening, because it involves, how can I put it, a kind of malevolence.
Yes, said Gwenda. Malevolence is just right. Even, I think, something that isn't quite sane.
She shivered. That is indicated, I think, said Miss Marple. You know, there's a great deal of, well, queerness about, more than people imagine. I have seen some of it. Her face was thoughtful.
End of Disc 2.